Tonight we are back talking with Dave Talbot and Wal Thornhill about Deep Impact. So, David, what are the chances of not much happening?
Well, not much will happen if there's a malfunction just before
I'm
they
not
launch
talking
the,
about a,
the projectile.
Yeah, I'm not talking about a miss. I'm just talking about so it hits the comet, knocks off a few chunks of rocks, and the comet just shrugs and says, big deal.
I guess my confidence level is extremely high that there will be a level of shock to mainstream scientists. I can't say with highest confidence exactly where that shock will be, because the constituent material of this comet is not known. But from everything we've observed, and inherent in the theory of the electric comet, is this high likelihood that what will be thrown up is much more dust and rock than water. So my personal expectation is that there will be substantial surprise expressed to astonishment at the missing water. Now, I don't know this, but I think that is a very high possibility. The other thing would be energetic signatures, X-rays, temperatures, and so on, that are not associated typically with impacts.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe I could fill in a bit there.
Yeah, go ahead.
Back in October 2001, I wrote on my website some predictions, and I stand by them today. I said that the energetic effect of the encounter should exceed that of a simple physical impact, in the same way that was seen with Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 at Jupiter. I expect changes to the appearance of the jets before impact. In other words, if there are any existing jets, they may suddenly switch position as this object closes in. The signature of an electrical discharge would be a high-energy burst of electrical noise across a wide spectrum, a flash, if you like, from infrared to ultraviolet, and enhanced emission of X-rays from the vicinity of the projectile. Because, in effect, the copper projectile will act like the anode in a dentist's X-ray machine. With electrons impinging on it, it will generate X-rays. Of course, the energy of a simple mechanical impact is not sufficient to generate the kind of X-rays that I'm expecting they'll find. There's a couple of interesting possibilities, too, which I mentioned back in 2001. If the arc is sufficiently of sufficient duration, it may actually vaporize the copper projectile before it hits the comet, and therefore it will not form the crater expected, but it will create an electrical crater on the comet. If the copper projectile manages to withstand the discharge and strike the comet, you'll end up with two craters, one electrical and one impact. And that certainly is not expected by traditional modeling. On the other hand, any copper metal reaching the surface of the comet will act as a focus for an arc from the comet. And copper can sustain a much higher current density than rock or ice. There would then be the likelihood of an intense arc with possibly a single jet from the comet nucleus until the copper is electrically machined from the comet's surface.
Wow.
So we should then see copper atoms ionized to a surprisingly high degree.
Why did NASA pick copper, David?
Pardon me, Jeff?
Why did NASA select copper for the projectile?
I think Wall would be the one to answer that.
Is there something to tie into your electrical universe theory?
I don't think so, but it's a good question, I'll tell you that.
It was very kind of them to do that. I'm not sure why they did it.
That's a very exciting possibility that you've just mentioned there, and that is the copper projectile itself becoming a focal point of much more intense arcing, and that does make perfect sense because of its much, much greater conductivity. And can you just imagine the surprise that they would express over that? I love that possibility.
The other thing is that a strong electrical discharge from a single point on a poor conductor like the comet nucleus can be disruptive, as I said before, the same thing that split apart Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9. And it could be responsible for breaking the comet up. Whereas a mechanical impact of that magnitude, I wouldn't consider to be sufficient to break apart a rocky
by
object.
Any means. No, there's a pretty definitive possibility right there. Wow. The temperatures, if the copper projectile makes it to the nucleus and becomes the focal point of a much more energetic jet, then they will see residual temperatures while that process is underway that would be unthinkable in terms of a sudden impact event, which is just, the energy is just very sudden and then rapidly diminishes. And you would see an extended high energy event, and that would be another very definitive electrical.
Have any of the scientists at NASA even backhandedly paid you guys a compliment and suggested there might be some unusual electrical activity in this impact?
No, not to my knowledge.
And yet, you know, surprisingly, they are acknowledging certain things. I mean, they are recognizing now certain interesting roles of magnetic fields, and they're even using the phrase charge exchange to account for the utterly astonishing temperatures that have been observed with comets, like Comet Borelli, 2 million degrees coma temperatures measured.
All right, just define coma for us, just so everyone knows.
Wall probably would use words a little more precisely than I would, so I'd like to defer to him on that.
A comet's coma, Walt.
Yeah, a coma is the like a spherical shape that surrounds the comet and gives it that fuzzy appearance.
Out in front of the nose of it, too. It's pushing that field in front of it.
Even that's a mystery in the end. That's a mystery. And a coma can be a million miles or more in diameter. And what holds that in place under the force of the solar wind and so on? I mean, why is it maintaining that roughly spherical?
How much of a factor is the solar wind to these cometary bodies as they whip through the solar system? I mean, we think of friction in our atmosphere, and the solar wind is a very distant relative of that concept, but there is something to it, I guess, isn't there?
Yes, if we stop looking at the solar wind as being a wind and instead part of the electrical circuit embodying the sun, then the solar wind is part of the electric current flowing from the sun, and therefore the comet interacts quite strongly with it.
Uh-huh.
It's noticeable that comets tend to disintegrate as they pass through the plane of the solar wind, which is interesting because that's what we'd expect in the electrical model, but it has no real explanation based on simple radiation damage from the sun and so on. So the comet does react strongly to fluctuations in the electric current flowing in the solar wind.
Interesting. What are the, Dave, a lot of planning went into this item, and I guess the spacecraft itself is about the size of an SUV. It's pretty good size.
I think that was the language that I picked up, and NASA has in recent years really had to adapt to budget constraints. And that's a whole nother question here because, in a sense, the ideologies of conventional science today are their own worst, are the scientists' own worst enemies because they live off of public financing in most instances. And if we could just inject a little inspiration and fire of discovery into sciences today, it would have reverberations through all of the sciences, through education and so on. I mean, science really is in a crisis, and particularly in this country, there's no sense of inspiration or discovery left almost. And there's a kind of smugness, figuring that they've pretty well got the universe mapped out and comprehended.
There isn't.
And we're saying they're miles off.
Well, miles, light years off.
Light years, yeah.
No, it always is, it is amazing to watch the smugness, the arrogance, the conceit of this tawdry little species on this dirty, dying world of ours.
Very good, Jeff. And self-serving. I mean, it's really sad to see how much the funding consideration now is coming in to dominate science. And you just read the news releases from the major scientific institutions today, and they are continually congratulating themselves for having resolved mysteries and so on, where they've only made the answers more complex and everything more mystifying. And funding is a really powerful force behind this confirmation by news release. This is what we're seeing all the time.
Research by proclamation.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. And
we need an electrical shock.
But the distinction between fact and theory, it's been completely obliterated.
Right.
Every news release you read now from official institutions of science will cite wild speculations as fact. I mean, principles that just emerged as guesses are gradually crystallized into dogma and stated in the news releases as fact. And one is comet such and such, which originated out in the Oort cloud. I mean, nobody has confirmed that there's an Oort cloud out there, Jeff.
They haven't.
Didn't even come close.
All right, stand by. Hold. That's. I didn't know that. Hold on. I'll be right back. So, beyond what we've discussed so far, what is the real appeal of this to the public? It's kind of like it's a spectacle, right? It's a deep space spectacle. The public isn't expecting anything revolutionary to come from this, or is it?
I think there may be a kind of deep human fascination with comets that goes all the way back to archaic times.
Well, back in the old days when we talked in the past about how the skies were the greatest big screen television that back then humanity could ever imagine.
This brings us to doomsday anxiety, Jeff.
It does.
We'll never escape this culturally, and it will always be there, but we certainly can bring it more fully into the light of day. And a comet is very much a part of the cultural anxiety that has hung it like clouds over civilization on every continent. And you can see this by just simply following backwards the myths and symbols to the very earliest expressions at the dawn of civilization. Cometary phenomena are exceptionally prominent. And a comet coming into view as just a little wisp of smoke has the capability of provoking deadly anxiety. And we've seen that even in modern times. The little troop of...
Well, look how the public...
the name of the guru.
Look how the public reacted to Halley's. I mean, people were actually stuffing cloth in their keyholes, sealing up their windows because they were afraid that cometary dust was going, or gas would kill them.
Yes, and I was thinking specifically of the little group that committed suicide
Heaven's Gate.
In the presence of a Hale-Bopp, but I'm not remembering.
Well, that's Heaven's Gate. And
the Heaven's Gate
now,
group.
Now, see, the problem with Heaven's Gate is that they became obsessed with the false internet story that there was a companion following the comet.
Yes.
It was a lie. We eventually found out that, in fact, I broke the story right here, thanks to my webmaster, James Neff, and Oliver Haino of the University of Hawaii Observatory. He found the original picture, which had been rotated either 90 or 180 degrees, and the second object, the addition, was
just
photoshopped in there. I mean, he found it.
Photoshopped in there.
Whatever it was,
not
it was added.
Not a background star or something showed up because they rotated it.
No. It was an addition. And I broke the story, and It's a tragedy that those people all died, but that had a great deal to do with apparently their mass suicide.
Yes, I can imagine. So here was a random incident or a little trick pulled by someone that actually
took on a life of its own.
Something on a much larger level, which comes under the heading of doomsday anxiety. Now, since the dawn of human history, comets have meant the end of the world, but we don't comprehend that. There was an event that occurred early in human history that passed into storytelling as the end of the world. This was in a time when the sky had nothing in common with our sky today. If we can bring the doomsday memories to clarity sufficiently, we can address the doomsday anxiety. But if it all hangs back there just in this cloud, it's continually able to have us seeing signs in the sky that don't actually mean anything. It's the same thing as the calendar events. In our counting system, the changing millennium became a trigger for doomsday anxiety. But our calendar system is completely arbitrary as to the zeros lining up in the system.
Right.
And the Aztecs, for example, used a completely different count. But at the appointed time when the day counts lined up every 52 years, the people expected the end of the world. They expected exactly the same thing when a comet appeared in the sky. So these things are very mystifying to us today, and we recognize the irrationality of these fears consciously. But we're not yet culturally tuned in to the historic origins to see that the most traumatic events in human history occurred only a few thousand years ago. And every defining feature of the early civilizations was a reflection of events that are not occurring now. So comets today are part of this overall symbolism. And to just learn more about what a comet really is, we will not just improve our scientific understanding, but we will come to know much more about human origins and the nature of the ancient sky. It is the electric universe that unifies these two inquiries.
Not just the electric solar system, the electric universe.
Right.
Now, you said something. We're going to a break, and when we come back, people have talked about the Oort cloud for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And you're suggesting that it is perhaps a complete fabrication.
Total fiction. I mean, nobody has any persuasive reason to convince us of this. There's nothing whatsoever other than it became a convenient reference within the theoretical framework that they're working. But a completely different framework is available here.
Fascinating. All right. Hold on, gang. We'll pause and come right back. Okay, we've got a featured story up there at Rents.com now at the top. Smashing a probe into a comet, and when you click on the Deep Impact Related Links page, you'll come up with two of Dave Talbot's articles. and the Kitt Peak National Observatory link and the animation link and planetary.org. We're all linked on that one page. So it's all right there for all of you who want to follow this, and hopefully many of you will.
Right. Wow, Jeff. You work very fast.
Well, James,
I should send you the links to the pages that I did, which predicted what would happen some years
that
ago.
That is super, if you could.
Sure, send
you
them
could
on
pass
over.
That on to him.
Yeah.
Well, that would be super.
Send them over. No problem. Yeah, just it's amazing to be able to work with someone, a professional, who will do what I ask and do it quickly.
This is terrific. This material by Wall will be a particularly telling reference because it goes back some time, and Wall's been willing to stick his neck out, but he always does it with discretion and a lot of forethought, and his record is exceptionally good so far on predictions.
Good. All right. Let's just for a moment, if we can, and you've spent, both of you, so much time over the years looking back at the roots of every cultural center, every center of civilization on the planet. All races, creeds, religions basically have the same
underlying patterns.
It's the same archetype of the great disaster, whether it's a flood, a con, it doesn't matter. There's always a catastrophic genesis at the core or the ancient roots of almost every society. I think you check them all, and they all have one, right?
I know of no culture that failed to remember the end of the world. The end of the world meant the passing of a world age, the collapse of the age of gods and wonders, a time that was never, never reenacted in their history. So they would always look back with a combination of yearning and terror. This is an extraordinary phenomenon that has gotten almost no attention from scholarly studies. But once you recognize that it is there, you will see these highly enigmatic combinations of yearning and terror. They were yearning for a return to the Golden Age, which is this shining epoch at the beginning of cosmic history in the age of the gods. And they were fearing a return of the end of the return of the doomsday catastrophe, which was the cataclysmic occasion that brought the Golden Age to an end. And they all recognized, every culture recognized, that that ancient sky looked nothing like our sky. We, however, as scientists looking back, historians and comparative mythologists looking back, we keep asking our sky to explain their cosmic imagery, and we leave nothing explained. There is not a single theme in the ancient world, no recurring theme or point of agreement between the ancient cultures that has anything to do with our sky. This is the profound fact that will someday change our understanding of ancient history completely. And that will be accompanied by a radical change in our understanding of solar system history, because the two go together. The history of our solar system has nothing in common with the textbook story. Planets just moving like clockwork around the sun, nothing happening to get excited about. We're saying everything that the ancient cultures were most concerned with, were obsessively concerned with, related to an unstable, electrically active planetary system. And planetary gods and goddesses towered over the world. That's the picture that the ancient poets and chroniclers give us. Planetary powers towering over the world in a highly active, very rich plasma environment, configurations metamorphosing from one form into another. And this was the nature of myth, to describe these events in terms of this explosive outpouring of imaginative interpretations of what this was. Beneath the imaginative interpretations, you have the patterns of agreement between the different cultures. Mm-hmm. One was, mm-hmm. there was once a golden age. It was the beginning of cosmic history.
Right.
Another was, there was a great catastrophe that devastated the world, altered cosmic history. And we on Earth, each culture was saying this, we shall, through our collective energy, build monuments to this extraordinary time and recreate symbolically in our land a replica of that ancient order. These things just are not recognized by historians generally, but once you hold to that thought, you will see it in every culture. That's what they were doing. They were only looking backwards. It's just they were not looking backwards to something that is here now. They were looking backwards to something that was here once. It's so obvious in the end.
It is, and your earlier production, I don't know how many years ago it has been now, Remembering the End of the World, how
yes.
many?
Almost, well, 9 years, 96.
Wow. I remember seeing that, and I was so impressed back then. I'm wondering, and as your and Wall's knowledge has increased over the years, I wonder how much of that has held up, Dave. I know your science has,
science
by virtue
came
of
in.
Science, yeah.
In the name of Wall Thornhill, I might just tell that story very quickly. I had reconstructed these configurations, and I knew planets were intimately involved in them, and the configurations got very detailed, and I stand by those completely now. And that reconstruction went far beyond the things uh-huh. that were presented in the uh-huh. video, Remembering the End of the World.
Yeah.
But to my good fortune, Wall Thornhill encountered that. And he spent 30 days in my office, late in 96, early 97, in connection with an international conference we were both participating in. He convinced me in that time in my office that what I had reconstructed were plasma discharge configurations, electrical discharge configurations close to the Earth, towering over the world. And nothing has been the same, but that all came after the video of Remembering the End of the World, Jeff. So I didn't know anything. I never used the word plasma.
Wow. Wow. All right. When we come back, what I'd like to do is, if I can, explore the work. I mean, this is fascinating work. Have you been to Clifford Carnicom's page, carnicom.com? He, the chemtrail researcher who has done so much science at home, literally with his own instrumentation, measuring things in the atmosphere which shouldn't be there in the concentrations they are. His theory basically is that the spraying operations, the aerosol operations, are creating or changing or modifying in the lower atmosphere a portion of it to reflect in some ways the same kind of electric plasma potential that exists in the ionosphere for use by the military, etc. Back with more. We'll talk about this in just a minute. That has been explored and researched by Clifford Carnicom, that's C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M, carnicom.com, include the patents of Dr. Bernard Eastland, and it's all there. Everything I suggested and 1,000 times more is there. The ionosphere has a plasma potential. The discharge of aluminum, barium, and other issues in the lower atmosphere at elevations of 20 to 30, 35, 40,000 feet by what appear to be spraying operations, do in fact create a static plasma field, which can be used apparently for a whole wide range of military and defense applications, and maybe civilian control and modification applications as well. Any thoughts on any of this? I know it's not exactly in your basket, but
Jeff,
it's intriguing.
Jeff, could you give me the spelling on that name again?
C-A-R-N-I.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Carnicom. C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M. I highly recommend you both spend some time on his website. With Your Electric Universe and his work, in terms of interpreting,
yeah.
Extrapolating Dr. Bernard Eastland's patents on the idea of using the Earth's atmosphere as a plasma field, as a medium, are fascinating, and they may somehow
we'll
link
that,
to your work.
We'll do that, Jeff, and report back to you. We will do that.
Yeah,
yes,
Clifford is a very good friend of this program and of me, and so what an extraordinarily bright man. So
Yes, we'll definitely report back to you.
Yeah, I've just brought up his website, and there's an enormous amount of material to look at. So
there is.
It looks very interesting.
And be sure you look at Eastland's patents. They're fascinating. And the interpretations that have come to roost on Clifford's website are just amazing.
I've had a long-term, unannounced, publicly unannounced interest in the whole issue of chemtrails. This will be a perfect reference for me.
Super. Well, I'm glad we made that connection. Very good. Okay, well, you've been very articulate, as always, about catastrophe history in the past of various cultures, all cultures as far as we know. We do know the Earth has, of course, been impacted. We have satellites to show us the areas of impact. We have groundwork to show us.
Oh, I just might mention in that connection that Origins of Doomsday Anxiety is actually up on your site. I have another one coming to you, Jeff, called Golden Age in Doomsday, to show that in every major culture, the integration was complete. The Golden Age and the Doomsday event
were
inextricably connected in every major culture.
And
we're not dealing with fragments. We're dealing with a unified human memory.
We're supposed to be thinking of our ancient past as a bunch of different compartments, which had no linkage to speak of, maybe some cursory trade here and there, and then when you move into the, two millennia ago, you start to get to more advanced trading, but there are things that, that you know about and Wall knows about, and I look forward to your next paper, which suggests that the world was far more linked in the ancient past than we would ever guess.
Yes, and particularly just in terms of the underlying human experience, there is an underpinning in ancient times for a kind of global experience, a global human memory expressed through many different mythological interpretations. But when you work through the surface of symbolism and mythology to the underlying experience, we find it's the same thing. There are actually, unbelievably, hundreds of points of agreement between the different cultures. When I started my own research, I'd have never dreamt of such a thing. In fact, I'd have thought of that possibility as being utterly absurd. But there are, documented now, and not just by my own work, but others who have come in as colleagues to take up many of the themes that I first elaborated. And this includes very capable researchers. And they have expanded the points of agreement between the different cultures to many hundreds. The list is at about 1,000 now. Not one of those themes is separated from any of the others. All are completely connected, and they give you a foundation in terms of human testimony, the recurring themes of the different cultures, a foundation for reconstructing experiences with which the modern world has no familiarity at all.
That's true.
Just a different world.
Here's a question from Sue. She emailed it in, and she asked, what do you gentlemen think of Sir James Jean's work? Has his foresight into how the universe works been inspirational to scientists?
Spell that last name.
J-E-A-N-S', James Jeans.
Yeah, I've read some of Sir James Jeans' work, and he was very imaginative, and I enjoyed reading it, but when it comes to the electrical nature of the universe, I've had to turn to engineers, electrical engineers in the main part to try and figure it out.
How many more near-Earth items are there plotted and coming near? And, of course, we just had another not-too-long-ago event, which was discovered after the object had actually whipped past the Earth. I mean, you get these reports. By the way, we just found an object the size of a car that has just passed between the Earth and the Moon.
Yeah.
And, by the way, it was so low, it actually went under some of our satellites.
Oh, no kidding. Well, that's interesting. I think we've probably got a fair amount of that that is completely undetected, and we detect it and announce it after the fact when we're certain that everybody's safe.
Exactly. Well, that's the pattern I'm seeing.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if, now, honestly, if they determined something was going to impact, why would they tell us? Why should they? Should they?
I think Wall has an interesting observation for you, Jeff, on this possibility of it impacting. It's a little different perspective. Wall, why don't you give your thought on this?
Well, just as I expect different things to occur at Comet Temple 1 when a projectile hits that, I would expect different things to occur on the Earth than the standard picture, and that is that a large object coming in at high speed would not adjust to the electrical environment of the Earth quickly enough, and so there would be a very powerful discharge between the Earth and the incoming object.
Prior to impact.
Yeah, in other words, Earth has its own inbuilt Star Wars system, if you like.
Oh.
And the result would be the disruption of the incoming object. That would create a crater on the Earth, an electrical crater, which wouldn't be very nice for those people who were near it. But the actual object coming in would probably be disrupted, and so you would end up with falls of sand and rock and meteorites and rubble rather than a single big object.
Mm-hmm.
There is, in fact, really solid historic evidence that this occurred and created the Chicago fire.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And Donnelly's Ragnarok, the Reign of Fire and Ice.
Fire and gravel.
You mean you're putting Mrs. O'Leary's cow out to pasture?
Yes, really, we are. It was a quite broadly experienced phenomenon in that area. And people spoke of the air growing parched and the fall of sand and there was
strange fires.
Yeah. St. Elmo's fire along the edges of buildings and various things that I think one used the word electrified.
The important thing was it was coincident with the disappearance of Biela's comet.
Yeah.
The flat-out disappearance of it?
Flat-out disappearance.
Yeah.
Never been seen since.
Yeah, it's amazing. So even more modern history is capable of some revisionism here, Jeff.
It's okay with me. I have nothing against revisionism.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's very healthy to examine the near and the distant past and try to bring facts into accord with our written history, which is written, of course, by the winners and those with vested interests, and we are the losers.
Oh, absolutely. This is so pervasive. There's a lot of appreciation for this, though. There is a whole cultural group, and I'm sure you hear of the phrase cultural creatives all the time, and they're kind of distinguished by a skepticism of conventional, institutionalized science, religion, politics, anything.
Right.
And that is emerging as a really powerful influence in our culture. And when we speak of an end run, we speak with some confidence because of the genuine intellectual curiosity within that group. There's a lot of potential there. And I should hasten to add that we're not excluding the possibility of alliances within the sciences. We have some stunning alliances now. We can't even talk about them because it would be so risky to these people. But we do have people who are acknowledged leaders in their field. I mean, including the most respected in their field.
Wonderful.
Who are intimately involved with us now. This isn't just a little two- or three-man operation anymore, I should emphasize.
Yep. Well, very good. All right, Wall, a final comment from you. What is your biggest hope for this? What would you really like to see?
Maybe I can just read to you what I wrote back in 2001.
Please.
My closing comment, and this is based on the fact that this mission to Comet Temple 1 is a low-budget one. And I said the deep impact mission seems rather pointless when the cathode arcs are doing the job of exposing the comet's subsurface. However, if comets are an electrical phenomenon and have nothing to do with the formation of the solar system, then astronomers are bound to be baffled once more. And that could be worth every dollar NASA spends on deep impact.
Well said. Indeed.
That's great, Wall.
I concur with that. Wall, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Jeff.
As always, it's a pleasure. And David, we'll all watch to see what happens. Is it actually then very early a.m. on the 4th? Is that it?
Well, depending where you are. West Coast time, it's actually close to 11 o'clock the evening of the 3rd.
Of the 3rd, right.
So, Jeff, you'll be one of the first that I'll email.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Just to alert you as to what's happened.
I look forward to it, and I'm glad that we connected on Clifford's work and enjoy that.
Yes, we'll talk. You betcha.
Good night, gentlemen.
Many thanks, Jeff.
Bye now. Good. Thanks, Jeff.
Good night. Okay, we're going to pause and come right back and head down to Roswell, New Mexico for a chat with Tom Carey and Don Schmidt next.